Dr. Brian Parsons. He's the director of Ghost Help, which is formerly Ohio Paranormal Investigations Network and has been investigating ghostly claims since 1996. He's written 6 books: Handbook for the Amateur Paranormal Investigator, Ghost Hunter, How to Become a Successful Paranormal Group, as well as Betty's Ghost, A Guide to Paranormal Investigation, and several other books pertaining to the investigation of ghosts. He employs a unique methodology to ghost hunting of client-centered investigation that utilizes a skeptical foundation, psychology, advanced interviewing skills, parapsychology, spiritualism, as well as the ghost excavation methodology. It very much breaks the mold of what you would see on paranormal investigative television shows. Brian joins us on today's episode of The Grave Talks. Brian, I'm going to start out with a very, very broad stroke question. How do you classify something as being paranormal when we're talking about ghosts?
Well, I'm not so much a fan of the classification systems that I see a lot of people talking about or writing about, putting in books or blogs and on television shows and all these other things. I think we're trying to do what we normally do, and like what scientists do, they like to classify things based on different either DNA classifications or what they eat or what they do. And I think we're getting, as far as the ghost aspect is concerned, I think we're getting a little too carried away. We're putting the cart before the horse. You know, let's figure out what ghosts are first, or how we can connect with them, or how we can interact with them in a logical manner instead of kind of a pseudo-scientifical or subjective manner before we start classifying things. And I think parapsychologists and psychical researchers who came before them have done a fairly good job of corralling the kind of loose definitions. And these are just based on observations and or case studies. So this is just kind of essentially what we're doing as amateur ghost investigators, is they've looked at individual cases throughout time over history and kind of put different things together to make kind of a viewpoint or a picture as to what's happening. And so I kind of side with the typical parapsychological definitions, and that's essentially your intelligent apparition and your repetitive haunting, your traditional or true haunting, whatever prefix you want to attach to it. And I just like to stick with those two basic things, because if we start getting too far away from all that, we can kind of take certain things like shadow ghosts, for example. A lot of people like to classify shadow ghosts as this individual type of ghost, and it's a subset of this, and it's related to that, and it could be a, you know, part demon or whatever, wherever people end up going with this stuff. And I think it's, let's just keep it simple. Let's not get too carried away with classifying. Let's just observe. Let's just do our work. Let's just collect data before we start naming things or classifying things. But if it's based on observation and we're seeing things that are happening that defy what is common thought, well, that's good, but that's just data. Let's collect all this information and then get together and try to figure out where all this is going before we start putting names so we can sell books or TV shows.
Let's talk about that for a minute. All the television shows that exist today, it's far too many that I think even most of us know exist. Seems you turn it on and you suddenly realize, oh, there's another show taking on ghost hunting from this angle or that angle. With the advent of ghost television shows and now 10, 15 years into a world where these are on at least one channel at almost any given time, how is it that they seem to always be getting very, very compelling evidence for the camera?
Well, I think that the thing that we have to realize is these ghost TV shows, it's multifaceted. You know, we're looking at it in one dimensional. We're saying, well, this product is garbage, because we know, all of us, that anybody's ever set foot in a haunted location, you may go hours or even days or days and weeks without ever getting anything really good. And then you can jump to conclusions and find stuff all the time, but we know that all these things don't happen. So a lot of people will instantly point the finger and say that these people are lying, or this is wrong, or that's wrong, or they're, you know, portraying things incorrectly. And I think most of the people, and I'm saying the ghost investigators that are present at these locations, I think they mean well and they're trying to do the right thing. I think once you start adding in trying to sell cars, which is what TV shows are trying to do. Ultimately, they're selling advertising spots. They need that blend of entertainment, flashiness, a little sexiness with your hair spiked up and a short t-shirt on, with your muscles hanging out. You got to have that kind of stuff to bring viewers in. And so the storylines, I think, sometimes get a little twisted. And we've heard a lot of stories about that over the years, where certain evidence or certain things that are going on in certain locations, these people should have known about this, or they're getting the history wrong, and they're just throwing out different names that really aren't technically associated with these locations. But again, it's all down to the production company. And when you do a television show, you can have the best intentions and say, this is how I want it to work. But ultimately, you're dealing with a room full of producers. You're dealing with a product that changes hands numerous times. It's not just one company. One company will film it. Another company will produce it. Another company will sell it to an even larger distributing company. So it changes hands so many times. And you know, even the people that are involved in these things, they don't know what they're going to see until the show comes out on TV. So there's so much to these things. And, you know, tying it into kind of the youth and the younger people that are coming in, I think they really need to understand this, that these TV shows, there is an ounce of reality, but it's an ounce. And there's a heaping helpful of a lot of other things that are bad for your intestines, more or less, to put it nicely. And they need to realize that going into these things, that it's not what you see on TV. And unfortunately, you see a lot of these groups emulate or simulate what they see on television through their investigation methods and their YouTube videos and their Facebook live feeds and all these things. I see people just trying to copy or replicate that. And unfortunately, that's all they have to go on. So you really can't blame the people that are copying all this, because that's really all they've had to go on in the last, it's been 14 years that Ghost Hunter's been on television. So that's a whole generation of people that have grown up on ghost hunting TV shows.
With the television shows, it certainly sparked the interest of people in the paranormal, almost making it much more of an acceptable proposition to become an amateur ghost hunter, someone without many tools or much experience. How would you say they go about beginning that journey?
Well, I think the one thing you said, I think, actually gives them a leg up on other people, is if they don't have any tools. That's actually the best way to go into any location, is without tools, because tools that you see, people are using these thinking that they're getting interactions with ghosts, or assuming that a ghost is lighting up a K2 or a ghost is leaving you an EVP or all these other things, or any movement or sound is created by a ghost. Unfortunately, that's just us being amped up. You know, we get the ghost thrill, we go into the location, and every little sound and thing that happens is a ghost. So if you go in without tools and just observe and just get used to those types of environments, which is what I always recommend when I had new investigators, I never wanted them touching a tool. Just go in and just observe your own feelings, observe your own, you know, feel your own body, and how do you feel relaxed, or do you feel nervous? Do you feel tense? Do you feel excitement? Pay attention to your emotions and how you feel about being in an environment. Because a lot of us that have been doing this for a long time, I've been doing this for over 20 years now, I can go into a location, and I'm not saying I'm psychic, but I can go into a location, I can really feel that location. I can feel, you know, in your gut, you just feel something is just not right, or something is maybe there, or it's just some sort of feeling you get with certain locations. And other locations you can walk into and you feel absolutely nothing, even the spookiest, scariest ones. For example, Waverly Hills. I went into Waverly Hills, I felt nothing. It just seemed like an old empty building to me. There was really nothing exciting there as far as I was concerned physically. So I think the biggest thing I can tell anybody, if you don't have any equipment, you're going to do this for the first time, probably want to pair up with somebody who knows what they're doing, but also just go in and just feel your emotions. Just get connect with that building. Don't worry about tools. Don't worry about EVP or even seances or any kind of spiritual sessions. Just go in there and be one with that building, and you'll be amazed at the kind of things that you'll feel or maybe hear or have happen to you.
When someone's going in to investigate a haunted location, or even pay to investigate a proposed haunted location, what sort of mindset would you say would be healthy to have going into that situation?
Well, I think if you're going to pay $500 to be in a building for 4 hours, have as much fun as you can. You know, just don't worry about proving anything to anybody else, because an overwhelming percentage, I don't even want to give a number, it's well beyond 99% of anything you encounter out there is either subjective, meaning it's something that you maybe misinterpreted as a ghost, or it's just something that you're never going to be able to record anyway, even if it is potentially a ghost. And you'll never be able to prove that to anybody else unless you do these kind of things over and over again in a controlled location and you're using a scientific process and your work is being followed up and disseminated by other people. There's a lot that goes into being able to prove something to somebody else. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with going into these locations and just having your own personal experience. It's when people try to tell other people, this is this specific ghost, or this is this event happening, this is definitely a ghost, or this picture was the ghost of this certain person. That's where I kind of draw the line. I think that's a little wrong to mislead people into interpreting your data as evidence, because evidence means beyond the shadow of a doubt. Something evidence is something that you can prove in the court of law, and that's going pretty far for a blurry picture of something that could just be a reflection of something, or you know, the flash, or some sort of camera malfunction, or just your misinterpretation of evidence, or a footstep on a digital recorder. I don't think that would stand up in court. But it's okay to say, hey, we collected these neat things, this potential data. It was fun. It was exciting. We had a great time. Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong. But it's when people are trying to prove to other people, because then you end up with hurt feelings. Other people will say, well, did you think about this, or did you look into that? And then all of a sudden people are getting upset and saying, how dare you, you know, say something bad about my evidence and things. But
one could argue paranormal tourism is disrespecting the dead. Others could say it very much respects them, because in many cases it's keeping locations that would otherwise be demolished, destroyed, or turned into something else alive, and almost a habitat, if you will, for the dead. Sometimes these properties are certainly for profit. Some the money is going to just keep the building and the property standing. What's your opinion on what we're now seeing with paranormal tourism and people paying to go and investigate haunted locations?
Yeah, I think when you get into for-profit, it's the water is kind of muddy, and it depends on the location. It depends on, you know, what they're trying to do. I mean, obviously, if it's dealing with the dead or people that were murdered, or some kind of event happened, you know, if let's say the Twin Towers, for example, if they started to sell tickets for ghost hunters at that location, I'm sure a lot of people would have a major, major problem with that. And I'm sure the government would step in. It would be a major problem. But then you go to locations like Mansfield Reformatory, Moundsville, for example. These places really aren't dealing with the dead, even though a lot of them will say, well, a lot of people were killed here or died here. That's not really what they're selling tickets for. They're selling tickets to interact with spirits, with ghosts, or with the haunted type of things that I mentioned. Haunting is basically residual energy that's locked into a location. So a lot of people will see and hear things that were part of the daily routine of the prison life. It's not so much seeing ghosts, it's seeing what happened during that lifetime. And you know, a place like Moundsville and a place like Mansfield Reformatory, you know, obviously tied into what you said, they're fighting to keep these buildings from being taken and torn down for other means. And a lot of these buildings are very historical, you know, not just because Mansfield Reformatory had a couple of really cool movies, including Shawshank Redemption, but it's also a Civil War site. There's a Civil War graveyard behind it that you're not allowed to get to, for various reasons, including that it's just not appropriate for the ghost people to get back there. Not to mention that there's a medium security prison behind there. So there's a multitude of reasons, and there's a lot of gray areas. But I think when you're dealing with people that were either killed in a location, or it's a site where historically people have died, I think there's a little bit of an issue with that. And I think also when you're talking about Civil War battle sites. I have a kind of an issue with that as well, and it seems that the National Park Service also has an issue with that because they're basically not letting people do that anymore, which is kind of a good and bad thing because it used to be a very big draw for them. And then now that they've said that you can't go in there at night and do these things, it's kind of shoot a lot of people away. But I think that's all for the better. It's just kind of, to me, it's disrespectful of these locations, of the historical aspect of these locations, let alone the people, you know, that died during these battles.
Let me ask you, how do you go about finding a location to investigate?
Well, that's kind of a sore subject between myself and other people that want to do this, because I'm not in favor of, again, spilling out hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to go and parade around in a dark, old, abandoned building for 4 or 5 hours. To me, that's not a productive use of my time or money, unless it's, again, if it's for entertainment. But I'm more in search of trying to figure things out. I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. So for me, I'm more inclined to do the client aspect of cases. But even that's gotten to the point of ridiculousness because clients expect you to do things a certain way. So through emails, and obviously we've been doing this for so long, I can vet different areas based on how much they're charging, or there are certain times that you can go into these locations and save a lot of money, or if you network with other groups, you can probably save a lot of money to go into these locations as well. But for me, I have my favorite places like Mansfield Reformatory. I've been going to there for a number of years. It's one of the first places I ever went to. So it's a comfortable place, and it's somewhere that I'm familiar with, and I'm used to the environment. So I can easily go into a location, even if I'm spending a few hundred bucks, and quickly get into doing what kind of work I want to do. If I'm doing a certain series of experiments, I can do that there. So for me, it's just about knowing these locations ahead of time. You know, and on a side note, we were talking about these places taking money. Years ago, before the TV shows, places like this would actually invite good groups out, and they would buy you pizza and allow you to sleep there. So they would basically pay you to investigate this place. And I guess it's people like us that have created the foundation for a lot of these stories, or you know, maybe the folklore behind these locations that's now drawing people in. And unfortunately, they're paying for that.
Is it ever a good idea to go into a ghost hunt or a ghost investigation knowing a lot of information about the haunt? Or would that possibly taint expectations or interpretations of what's experienced?
Well, that's always the million-dollar question. And a lot of groups will say, well, we don't want to be tainted. We don't want to have that preconceived notion of when we walk into a building to expect this particular ghost. But if you do more than just general browsing, so if you're going to go to the website that hosts this particular location, yeah, you're going to get the goodies. You're going to get the names and some of the events, and they're going to be twisted in a way that's going to sound entertaining. But if you take the time and the effort to go to local historical societies, you look up information online that can provide you the reality behind some of these stories or information, to going to maybe even local government buildings to dig up, maybe I shouldn't say dig up, but to find information on maybe people that were either murdered or had died at these locations, to provide the backup to these stories, I don't think you're really hurting yourself if you've really done that far of work. If you're only going to go so far, and again, you're only going there for entertainment, then you're kind of setting yourself up for those preconceived notions. So it's kind of a gray area. It depends on the investigator. Now, for me, I like to know what I'm walking into. So I will go the extra mile. I will find people that actually were in a prison or were actually involved in one of these locations. And I'll go to local historical societies. I'll go to local libraries and try to find information on the property, the owners, the locations, and try to dig up information that I can find to not necessarily validate or invalidate these stories, but just try to find the reality of what happened. And for me, I'm not so much concerned about who died in a location, but who lived there. People that were associated with a place for a long period of time, because those are the people that are going to more or less stick around as far as a residual type of ghost. I don't care about dramatic stories about people jumping off a roof or being hung at a location. That's all well and good, and some of these are circumstantial. So I'm just looking for names of people that were definitely associated with it and during specific time periods, so that we can kind of get a feel for, you know, what we're walking into, reality versus story, which can sometimes be very separated. You know, a lot of folklore around certain locations all over the world. I mean, obviously here in the United States, we're not as old as places in Europe and England, but there are a lot of urban legends and folklore that have grown up even in the past generation or two with a lot of locations, like crybaby bridges and you know, some local, we have a place called Helltown here in Ohio that's has a whole folklore thing of its own. In reality, the story is pretty boring. So it's just a matter of digging into that. If you're going to go and do it, then do it right. Don't just look up a couple of websites, the first two or three things that you find on Google, and take that as gospel. You know, look up a lot of different things and look for things that go against what you believe as well, to kind of balance that, because you'll be amazed at what you can find when you start digging, that some of these stories that are highly touted by these locations are actually not true.
Are there any locations, any purported haunted sites that you would simply not go into to investigate?
Well, I think the only reason I wouldn't do that is if it's, as an investigator, if it's somewhere that's either a sacred site or it's a religious site, or it's somewhere that obviously the respect of the dead or people that are associated with that. I think there should be a matter of respect that we have for the history of these locations, and not just because their family members are still alive, but for what happened at these locations historically. You know, as you go on vacation to go to certain historical places, and you know, in the back of your mind as a ghost investigator, you do ask yourself these questions. Gosh, would I really investigate here? You know, you go to the Bahamas and you go to these old, you know, old places, and you wonder, yeah, would I investigate here? Sure, you know, pirate history and all that would be really fun, and to hear other languages. But then you come, you know, here in the United States, you have, again, Civil War battlefields. It's kind of a gray area. Do you want to do that, or do you not want to do that based on what happened there? You know, the history is cool, but at the same time, people died here.
What about a situation where all too often the words demonic come up, dark entity, something very, very evil haunting a location? When you hear stories like that and you have someone that says, I'd like you to investigate this and see if you can tell me what's going on, would that hold you back at all?
For me, no. I'm not really, those things don't really scare me at all. I'm not really frightened by allegations or stories or urban legend or folklore. I mean, I embrace this stuff. That's what I'm here for. You know, if I was afraid of this stuff, I'm in the wrong field. You know, I investigate big cat sightings. So I go into woods and look for mountain lions. I mean, how crazy do you have to do stuff like that? I mean, this is a real living, breathing creature that is capable of stalking and killing a human being. That's how crazy I am. So I have no fear in going to a building with purported demon activity. And again, that goes to doing your research as well and looking into the history of a location or history of claims like this. I mean, there's all kinds of places that are like that are just like tourist traps. The axe murder house, you know, terrifying stories, but people go there and take their pictures like it's no big deal. So I guess it's part of a mentality. If you want to let it scare you, you can let it scare you. But for me, you know, probably more of a researcher than anything. I'm still an investigator, but as a researcher, you don't really let stories scare you, because you want to see these things for yourself. So I'm not really afraid of demons or things like that. Not that I really don't believe in them as a specific entity, but I believe in them as how other people perceive these. It's basically a religious belief, or a differing belief than other than ghosts. So I respect that in that regard. But for me personally, I don't really believe in it. So something I don't believe in, it's really not going to hurt me in that regard.
How do you personally go about capturing what people would call evidence of the paranormal?
Yeah, quote unquote. Evidence is again, it's beyond the shadow of a doubt. So in 20 years of investigating, I don't keep count. I don't know how people say that they've been on 845 investigations and all these. I have no clue. I never counted to begin with, but all the places I've been in, all the photographs I've taken, all the EVP I've captured, very, very few things really jump out at me that I can't argue against. And I'm my biggest skeptic against my own data or information I collect. I don't like calling it evidence because, again, evidence means that it's proving something. I attack my own stuff, and I've heard some really, you talk about demons. My friend and I were at Mansfield Reformatory in a cell, and we were talking, I don't remember what we were talking about, just having a casual conversation. And a lot of times this is when things happen. And he thought he heard something. So I had multiple recorders going. So I stopped one recorder, went back and listened. And there was this heavy demonic sound voice. I mean, it was obvious it was a voice listening, you know, with headphones on. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like really scary. And he listened to it. He's like freaking out. I was like, hold on, let me listen to my other recorder. Generally what I do is I have a live recorder running that's on my lapel. So I'm basically saying what's going on, where we're at, what time it is, just so I can do things like this. I can back things up. So I'd stop that recorder, go back, and I listen. And all it was he'd said something else, and it just, the recorder slowed down for some reason. And I guess the batteries were pretty low or something was wrong with that recorder. And it just sounded really weird. But had I just gone with that and said, hey, I got this great evidence, I'm sure a lot of people would have believed it. But I do the homework. I do the long way of doing things. I'll listen to things for hours and hours on end and try to correlate that. I don't set myself up by just putting one recorder in a room. I'm going to have multiple recorders. So in case something like this happens, I can verify it. So I'm kind of my own worst enemy in that regard because I don't want to be tricked by things. But very few pieces of evidence. And I'd say some of the best pieces of quote unquote evidence I've ever heard came from when working with basically, I guess you call them psychics for lack of a better term. A couple of them have just, when they're in the room, you just hear the most amazing things. And it's, I don't think it's a ghost per se. I think it's maybe them creating the correct environment for these things to leak through, especially on technology. But then again, you don't know. Is this leaking through to the recorder or is this being imprinted on the recorder? So that's where you run into that gray area. But as far as anything I can prove to anybody, I've never posted anything on a website or Facebook page or anything that was something that I would say is definitively a ghost or something that I thought was. Now, there's a lot of stuff I've posted that I say, what do you guys think? And people will jump in, well, wow, that's an orb, or that's this, or that's that. But it's usually because I've already done the work to figure out what it is. And just use that as a teachable moment to tell people, hey, this was this in this location. So be on the lookout when you go to this particular place.
Beyond a tape recorder, do you use or do you recommend using other pieces of equipment for trying to capture data on ghosts?
Well, I do use EMF detectors. A variety, and I don't use the K2 or any of the basic ones, because essentially you're getting what you pay for, and a K2 is a single axis. You really want a tri-axis EMF detector, but I use those for what they're intended. And if I'm going to go through and do an investigation, I want to look for loose wiring. I want to look for natural EMF spikes that are happening, that, you know, bad wiring or bad grounding that's going on in a location, especially in the client case. You want to make sure that you're eliminating anything that could be causing anything before you go in and you know, act like Ghostbusters and find ghosts at every corner. If you can eliminate what's logical, then what you're left with is the things that you really have to ponder. So I do use the EMF detector. I guess everyone in the ghost field has flashlights, right? You have to have, that's a staple. I think we're all born with those. Even though I'm not a big fan of investigating in the dark for various reasons, not because I'm afraid of it, but I just think it's a waste of senses. And I mean, beyond that, I don't really use much in the way of tools. I don't get carried away with all these phone apps that people are using and all these quote made for ghost hunting unquote tools, because I don't understand how you can use a tool that's made to measure something that has not been proven to have any measurable characteristics to begin with. It's confusing. And a lot of those are just made for entertainment. If you look on the websites or look at the disclaimers, it says made for entertainment. So people that are using these and claiming that they're definitely getting ghosts, or that they're proving, or they have, here we with the E word again, with evidence of ghosts, you might want to look at the manual.
Let's talk a bit about how environmental factors can wreak havoc in what one may think is a haunted house or a haunted situation, from bad wiring to other influenceable factors that are actually physical with the house or the building itself. How can that affect human beings in what they perceive as a haunted situation?
Well, a pretty controversial thing, and some people claim that it's true and other people claim that it's not. There's research on both ends of this. But for me as a ghost investigator, electromagnetic hypersensitivity is a real thing as far as I'm concerned. And that's really and truly what I'm looking for. Some people are very aware of electronics, and for some people it makes them sick. But when you have a loose wire that's putting out, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of milligauss of, you know, we can relate to that, a lot of electricity floating in the air that's uncontrolled, that can pretty much make anybody feel queasy or sick, whether it's proven or not by science. I've seen it dozen times, and anytime that we've gone into a location, that's one of the first things we look for. Well, the kitchen, I always feel dizzy here. Okay, well, dizziness is a sign, is a symptom. The feeling of being watched is also a symptom. So it's things like that you'll look at. And again, if we find that, that's crossing one more thing off of our list. And so we'll, if you're sick in the kitchen, we'll look at the schematics of the house. Well, the basement is below the kitchen, and the fuse box is below the kitchen. So we go and we measure that, and if it's off the charts, well, then you need to call an electrician. Let's get this fixed as soon as possible, and then we'll come back and conduct an investigation. Again, we'll follow up with that. I've had at least two cases involving children that have had extreme nightmares or seeing ghosts, that they had either alarm clock in one case and a fish tank in another case that was setting off a very high level of EMF. So we had the family move that, and lo and behold, everything went away. But was it the moving the electronics? Was it affecting them, or was it just the mentality of, if we do this, this will fix it? You know, so was it just the whole thought of doing it, or was it the actual physical thing of doing it? We don't know. And the other thing too is CO2 detectors. I forgot to mention this. It's another thing that's in the bag. It's not something that I'll use all the time, but it's something that will go into a location and we'll plug these things in, especially in basements or rooms where people are saying they're having certain types of activity. If it's something that's fairly new, CO2 poisoning is a very huge thing, and it's very highly overlooked in the paranormal field for a potential explanation for these things. And believe it or not, a lot of cases you're having high levels of CO2, which causes people to hallucinate, hear things that aren't there, and a lot of even things that somebody would prescribe as having a mental issue, but it's caused by a physiological aspect. So it's those kind of tools that I use in the field to eliminate not only potential sources, but potential causes for them to see these things, physiological effects caused by the environment. And whether you believe in EMF hypersensitivity or not, it's worth the time to look into, and it's worth the time to work with that client, if you're dealing with a client, to help ease that situation, because that's really what you should be there for, not to capture proof of ghosts or to verify their claims. You should be there to help them. And if they want you to prove that a ghost is there for them, you might wonder what their entire motive is for, you know, if they've signed a television contract or something else, or what they're up to. But, you know, we should be there to solve the mystery, I guess, not to find ghosts, solve the mystery. Why is this happening here? And it doesn't matter what tool you bring in, it should be geared toward that.
What about situations that you go into and you try and narrow things down and find an answer that does not lie within the realm of paranormal activity? Is that a common occurrence for you?
Oh, absolutely. It happens quite a bit more than I'm willing to admit. A lot of times I'll walk away and just really, we don't have a clue. We can't answer. We can't figure it out. We can't find a logical explanation. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that there isn't one. It just means that we weren't able to find one. And usually the homeowner is accepting of that. But a lot of times people, when you come in to a location, they've already made up their mind. It's a ghost and it doesn't matter what you do. They're going to believe that till the end of time. And if you're not going to back them up on that, they'll find somebody who will. And they'll just kick you out of the house and bring in somebody who's going to capture whatever kind of evidence that supports their beliefs about what's happening, unfortunately. But that's just how it goes. But yeah, I've walked away from plenty of cases and it's just not sure what's really going on. Some of it doesn't add up to be actually being a ghost. Some of it's, I mean, you really can't argue it, but you can't really prove it at the same time. So you're just left with, wow, this is a good case, but how are we going to prove it to anybody else?
How does one who's gotten into the world of ghost hunting and investigating go about qualifying the individuals who contact them to investigate a haunting? And what I mean by qualifying is making sure that this is a safe place to investigate. This is, in fact, a safe person to be around who is contacting me to investigate, and that there's not some other motive or underlying possible medical condition that may be causing this individual to contact an investigator. How do you go about determining that when you get those calls?
Well, you know, I mentioned motive. You know, what are they trying to get? Are they trying to, we want you to come into our house to prove that a ghost is here, which unfortunately it seems like a lot of people want that nowadays. And I used to not take cases based on that kind of concept, but unfortunately I think television shows have created that culture of the expectation that you're going to be able to come in and prove that a ghost is here. And we really can't do that. But that used to be a sign to me that I would tell people don't take those cases. But unfortunately, like I said, it's become culture. But you want to look for people that are really rambling on, or they're obviously they're beyond, it's just beyond a ghost. If it's something that it sounds like something you can't handle, don't take it. You know, let somebody else handle it. Don't jump into something that you can't handle. And I think that's a hard thing for a lot of people because they're not sure what to really expect when you're first starting out. So they'll take anything they can and go into these people's houses. And it's in those cases, it's not the ghost that you should be worried about. It's not demons in the basement. It's being locked in the basement by the living people that you really have to be careful of. So it's be very wary of the living and look at these stories, look at what they're telling you. Kind of, does it make sense? Does it sound familiar? Does it sound like something maybe you saw on a TV show? Does it sound like something out of a book? If it sounds made up, it's probably made up. You know, just be willing to not take cases or to admit to people that, hey, we're starting out. This might not be the case for us. And, you know, be understanding too that you're dealing with living people. Like I said, not saying they're going to lock you in the basement, but you may deal with people that are using a ghost as an excuse for something else. Drug addictions, alcohol addictions, domestic disputes or domestic issues between them and their spouse. I mean, I've seen it all going into these locations. You think it's about a ghost, but it's really about the people living there. You know, a guy claims he was being abused by a ghost. Well, it was really he was abusing his wife and trying to blame it on this ghost. You know, things like that you're going to find, and you're not going to get that through an email exchange. You know, email is great. And like you said, anybody can set up a website. You can pop up a contact form. But I always recommend before you take a case, before you set foot into somebody's house, call them and talk to them. Have a long conversation because you're going to get way more information over an interview than you are through an email exchange. I mean, why are we talking to each other on this podcast? Because we're getting more information from each other going back and forth quickly. Then, you know, I could have easily written a bunch of questions, you know, answered a bunch of questions that you had and put them on a website. That's not good. You're not going to get that much value of information to go back and forth or to clarify questions or clarify information. So again, just be willing to admit you can't handle a case, but also be understanding that you're dealing with people. Don't worry about the ghosts, you know. The ghosts, if there is a ghost there, it'll happen. But again, solve the mystery. deal with the people, figure out what's going on, figure out what's really troubling them. If it's not a ghost, then, you know, again, if you're, unless you're a licensed counselor, you can't really counsel people. So you might want to sidestep a case that's it's more or less them having personal issues, or they're dealing with something else, such as an addiction or something else. And trust me, you'll get a lot of those cases if you're in this long enough.
What are some of the important questions you would ask someone when they're reaching out to you saying, I think I have a haunting, can you help me?
Well, obviously you want to ask, first and foremost, have they looked into any logical explanation? If their lights are flickering, have they called an electrician? Or have they just called you, some random bunch of guys with your arms folded on a webpage, you know, looking like badasses in a cemetery? So have they already just jumped to that conclusion without looking at other things? Because that might be a big tip-off. And I hate to be rude about this, but a lot of people are not very good problem solvers. And that'll tell you right away, if they've not made any effort to look at anything, they've just jumped on their cell phone and look up my local ghost group that just popped up 10 minutes ago and want you to come into my house, that might be a good, you know, like you said, red flag that maybe they haven't really worked through anything. They're just making an assumption, or maybe they're just believing in things. And also questions I like to ask to try to make it a little bit more personable. You ask them, well, this ghost is seemingly interacting with you. How do you feel about that? How does that make you feel? What do you feel the ghost is trying to communicate information with you? And why do you think this is happening to you? If you personalize it, you kind of spin it in their direction and see how they react to that. That kind of gives you a little bit of clarity. But again, a lot of it boils down to really understanding people and knowing how to interview people and knowing what you're getting. I mean, I've interviewed people for job positions for, gosh, 30 some odd years now. So you kind of get used to, when you deal with people, when you ask people questions, how they react to it, what their intentions are behind it, if they're just telling you what you want to hear, which is unfortunately what a lot of people do, and especially in job situations, or are they being genuine, or they're really being themselves. And with the case of turning these questions about the ghost to the people, because people ask you, well, what do you think the ghost wants? Well, I ask them, well, what do you think this particular ghost wants from you? When you switch that on them, you'll be amazed at when they answer that, you'll get a very clear kind of picture of how involved they really are, or if there's really this deep separation. Sometimes it's almost like people want you to come in and just take care of a mouse problem. Like, hey, we have this ghost, can you come in and take care of it for us? That's just weird to me, because there's some kind of a disconnect. They're not really afraid of it. And I hope people aren't afraid of things like this, because again, that just shows you that maybe they're not good problem solvers. But at the same time, there should be some sort of general concern about what's happening, instead of just calling a group of people in to zap it with their backpacks and put it in a trap and take it off to a holding facility in a basement, in an old firehouse, if you know where I'm going.
It's really an interesting thing. It, in some ways, in some areas, it almost feels as commonplace now, where people can call a paranormal investigation group the same way one would call the Orkin Man or an HVAC company if something is wrong with the heating in an air unit. If they suspect that there's something ghostly going on, there is now someone you can call that will show up, some better than others.
Yeah, that's what it's come down to almost. And it's sad. And, you know, for me, it was hard around, 2010 or 2008, 2009, that time period when groups were just exploding on the internet. It's when a lot of free websites were, you're able to drag and drop websites. And like you said, you know, and MySpace and Facebook and all this stuff was just really flourishing and becoming huge. And there were so many groups out there that client cases were really, really hard to get, because everyone was competing for them. And it was almost like you were competing for table scraps. And unfortunately, so many different types of groups, or so many groups out there that have been taking these cases for so long, it has changed, or what I call altering the culture of the investigation field. And especially now it's gone into the clients. I mean, you look at, orb pictures. Now, that back in the mid-1990s was just a paranormal investigator problem. This was just something that we were all arguing about amongst ourselves. And now it's, I mean, almost every case you go to, a client will show you their pictures and say, look, I got ghosts. These little bubbles are ghosts. It's like, no, those aren't ghosts. But, you know, it's trickle. All this stuff I've seen from being in this field for almost a generation now, I've seen it trickle down to the client. And it's frustrating because these are the mistakes that we've made and we've influenced the clients now. And it's really hard to bear because you feel guilty, you know, because you were a part of this, essentially. I mean, not specifically, but overall as a fixture in the culture, you know, we've allowed these things to trickle down to people, and it's really affecting client cases now. It's making them very, I would say it's a lot more difficult now to conduct a client case than it was even 10, 15 years ago.
I suppose it's also very difficult to go into some homes these days where if someone isn't an avid viewer of a ghost show, they may be expecting you to come in with an array of the latest ghost sensing equipment that they saw on last week's episode and probably somewhat shocked if you're not using it and may even call into question your legitimacy for not having such equipment.
Yeah, and I know a lot of listeners are listening to me talk and say, well, this guy's really skeptical and this guy, he doesn't understand all these things of what they can really do. No, I do. I've been in these locations. I've used these tools, and I can tell you that they're really not giving you what you think you're getting. And I've made my mistakes. I've fallen in love with certain things and realized later on that I was wrong. Like I can't believe I believed in this. And never over pictures, by the way, but we did a lot of work with that back when digital cameras were still basically too expensive to own. So it's doing the field work on these tools. If you do enough work in the field with them before you get them or before you use them in the field, you'll find that they're not giving you what you think you are. You know, I had an argument with the guy about an obelisk, and he kept saying, you know, it's giving me specific words that I'm in these locations. It's telling me exactly what I want. And he says, well, you know, next weekend we're going to meet at this place, but I have my brother's birthday party before. I was like, good. I want you to take your obelisk to your brother's birthday party and ask questions about him and find out what this thing says. So then he came to the investigation later on. He's like, yeah, you're right. I'm not even bringing that thing anymore. It said basically the same words it does at all these haunted locations during a 10-year-old's birthday party. So these things aren't giving you what you want. I mean, the radio sweepers, it's just pareidolia. You're just hearing what you want to hear. And again, it comes down to these people are making money off of it. And other people are selling it to you because they're getting a kickback. They're getting these things for free, and they're telling you to buy this stuff. It's unfortunate. It's kind of the business aspect and the business part of it. So, I mean, I have become skeptical over time, but you should be skeptical because not everything that happens out there as a ghost. And if we can narrow down those things that aren't ghosts, or at least understand these things, A, not only can you help people, you can protect people from dying through CO2 poisoning or electrical problems or, you know, house burning down, all these things. But you'll learn a lot about science. You'll learn a lot about even geology. I mean, who would know that ghost cases sometimes can be solved by looking up earthquakes? These things happen. There's all kinds of fun, logical things you can learn. And then it's even more satisfying and gratifying when something paranormal does happen because you've already eliminated all these other things. To me, that's more exciting than just walking in and having a bunch of things light up and I'm thinking I'm talking to a ghost for 5 minutes.
You can find out more about Brian's research on his website, ghosthelp.net. That wraps up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, please help us grow. Help other people realize that we exist. That is done by subscribing to us on whatever podcast platform you choose to use and listen on, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, whatever it may be, and leaving us a review. Please do that. Let other folks know that we exist. Share our show in social media. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Grave Talks.